Welcome to episode 11 of the Fifth Estate. I am Jake Russo here along with my co-host Neil Dewing. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Jay. Doing very well indeed.
As we always say at the beginning of each episode, you know, hey, if you like the show, go out and go to iTunes, subscribe, leave a review, tell us how much you hate us, how much you love us. Doesn't matter. We appreciate it either way. We are very pleased this week to have a special guest with us. You know him from Dirty Jobs and MicroWorks Foundation. And if you're very familiar with him, you remember him way back from QVC. Mike Rowe is here joining us this week. Mike, thanks for being on.
Let me just say that I'm still awash with that tenor sax. It's the first time I've heard such a thing on a podcast. It really it makes me want to make a gimlet and light a cigar. And good for you guys.
That's great.
I'm not sure what kind of mood we're setting, but I like it.
Okay, yeah. I mean,
relaxed,
hey.
Casual, yeah. Just going to talk about, well, maybe the skills gap and a few other important issues facing the nation.
Well, nothing says let's close that skills gap like a saxophone,
yep.
Really. So, yeah, I'm totally down with it. I love
it. It's a skill.
Yeah, sure. Charlie Parker can set the mood for anything. So that's what we did there.
Love it.
But so, we are very excited to have you, Mike, and we definitely we think that you're a great guest to have on. We've as part of this podcast, we've touched on this issue before of this skills gap and the student loan crisis, and so we were just absolutely thrilled when you agreed to come and chit chat with us.
Well, look, it's my pleasure, and I do a lot of it, but before we get into it, before we completely abandon the saxophone, let me just say that last night, I don't know if you guys have it, but it's a Coltrane combo with Johnny Hartman, and if you don't have it, in particular, Lush Life, they do a take on Lush Life that is about the best thing I've heard in a long time. And if you really are bemoaning the state of Western civilization or the skills gap or the student loans or anything else, I mean, it's impossible not to listen to that and be restored in some way.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Neil probably won't like it, but I will.
No, I need it more than just about anybody else. So I
Neil,
think
all the... need it. We all need Johnny Coltrane and Hartman for sure.
Well, Mike, I mean, Neil and I have, we've discussed this in different forums and stuff, and we're both kind of like on the same page with the skills gap and people going to college, getting degrees that are kind of like they graduate with these degrees that they've spent, you know, $150,000, $200,000 on. And the prospect of them finding a job in that field is low. And even if they do, it's not going to pay them very much to be able to pay back those loans. And, you know, college just isn't for everybody. We have this thing, and I remember you reacted very strongly to something that Bernie Sanders had said about, you know, it's either college or jail, you know,
right.
And it was kind of a ridiculous statement because there's so many different things that people can do without a college degree, make a really good living doing it. And I know that that is something that's important to you. And so, you know, just to kind of start off, I mean, let's just back up a little bit and kind of tell people, When did this start to become a passion of yours? Like when was the first time that you kind of realized a light bulb went off and said, you know, this is, you know, we're heading down this path where we have people that can't do particular jobs, but the jobs are available. How do we change that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly long answer, but the short version for me is it really went full circle. I was very lucky to have grown up next to a kind of a magician who just happened to be my grandfather, who was one of those guys who could build a house without a blueprint and often did. And he was heroic, you know, to his community back in the 60s and 70s. He only went to the seventh grade, but by the time he was 30, he was a master electrician and a plumber and a steam fitter and a pipe fitter and a welder mm-hmm. and an architect. And, you know, that chip that exists in some people's minds is still an incredibly valuable thing. And to me, it always represented not just a skill most often embodied in handiwork, but in a state of mind and a different form of education and learning and knowledge. And I only point that out because it's a recessive gene. It skipped right over me. And, you know, what I got from growing up next to him and trying to follow in his footsteps for the first 20 years of my life was a real appreciation for the people who have that talent. And the degree to which they develop it is anybody's guess. But to show up to the party with a brain that works that way and the willingness to apply it, to me, is just a marvelous thing. And so I was always informed by the importance of that talent and by the fact that those people walk the earth. But for the next 30 years of my life, you know, I went to Hollywood and New York, and I did a lot of things that required a very different kind of toolbox. By the time Dirty Jobs came along, I was in my early 40s, and it was not long after 2011, and the country was sort of wrestling with the modern definition of what a good job was. And there was nothing on TV that really celebrated guys like my granddad and people who got dirty in the course of making a living, people who woke up clean and came home dirty. So having said that, the honest answer to your question was in 2008, when the show was at its peak, and in 212 countries, our economy crashed, as you might recall. And suddenly, Dirty Jobs and me, we became relevant in ways that the network and no one else really anticipated, because suddenly the headlines are all about the skills gap and unemployment and a crumbling infrastructure and currency devaluation and all these other things I wasn't really qualified to talk about. But because I was seen so widely as a guy who had a front row seat to work, I started getting a lot of questions from the media about how to reconcile things like a widening skills gap with rising unemployment. So I started to, I'd say, form a theory, but even that's a little too grand. I just started to go back to my journal and refer to the many notes I had taken along the way of doing Dirty Jobs and talking to a lot of employers in every major industry in every single state. And they all said the same thing. And it was a fascinating thing. They said the single biggest challenge facing them was always, without exception, finding people who were willing to take the time to learn a skill that was actually in demand. And I was still hearing the same story with unemployment rates at 12% when there were 2 or 3 million jobs that couldn't be filled. And it really just struck me as a giant disconnect that was alive and well in the country, as well as an alternative kind of narrative. Everybody was focused on unemployment, but to me, the most telling thing that something was fundamentally wrong was the existence of all of these decent jobs that paid great money that employers just could not find people to do. And sorry, that is kind of a long answer, but that's the truth of it. I started MicroWorks on Labor Day of 2008, really as a PR campaign for jobs that actually exist, mm-hmm. in hopes of connecting people and industries with those opportunities, because ultimately, I really think so much of what makes the skills gap wider and wider and wider is really crappy PR. That's what MicroWorks began as. We morphed into a work ethic scholarship program, and today we're both.
Well, you know, and Mike, you make such a great point. When you began Dirty Jobs and, you know, taking the example of your grandfather, there really was nothing in the cultural space that, you know, I don't want to say lionized this work, but just presented this work as an option. And, you know, I'm going to reveal my age here. I graduated high school in 2002, and I graduated from college in 2006. It was never an option for me to go to a trade school. It was never an option for me. It was never presented to me. My parents, it was just inconceivable. Yeah. All the guidance counselors, it was never something that they promoted. Some kids in my class had fathers who were tradesmen, electricians, welders, that sort of thing. And they had knowledge of this world, but they were not encouraged to follow in their father's footsteps or their mother's footsteps. They were encouraged to maybe join the Marines if that was an option. Right. You know, in 2002, go join the Marines, right? But so this was just something that I never heard. And really, you were probably the first person who really presented this to people like myself, you know, and said, this is a thing that not only can you do this work, not only is this work necessary, you can be happy in this work. And I've been fortunate enough in my working life to do some, you know, dirty jobs, you know, manual labor. I've done landscaping. I've done some house construction for a year after I graduated college. So I got a taste of that, and it's good work. And it's something that stays with you for your entire life. I can do finished carpentry. I can put down subflooring. I can drywall. These are things I'll carry with me. And I think people don't, or haven't up until now, really considered that.
No, because they're not really invited to consider it. What's happening, in my view, is that in the same way the definition of a good job is constantly up for grabs and always changing, so too is the definition of a good education. Mm-hmm. Those two things are linked really, really closely. And you can see the power of language when you step back from both of those things and try and find the way they're connected. You know, college, you weren't alive at the time, but college was in desperate need of a PR campaign of its own in the early 70s, mm-hmm. You know, and in the mid 60s, not enough people were going to college. Not enough people had a broad-based liberal arts background. And so a giant cultural shift started to happen where we began to make a case for a college education. But this is the trap of most PR. The temptation to say this is good is almost always accompanied by this is bad, or this is better than that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the prospect of college became a thing we promoted at the expense of apprenticeships and other forms of education. And you can really see it today, the way it's played out in the language. You know, a college education is called a higher education. And anything else that we would typically put under the blue collar umbrella, any kind of apprenticeship, any kind of trade schools, those things are all called alternative educations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right there, you set the table, you know, and if you put the question to a parent, if you say, do you think your kid should pursue a higher education or something alternative? Well, the choice is simple. One is aspirational and one is subordinate. And the minute the society bought into that language, I think that was really the moment right there. So many other things started to happen. Vocational education, for instance, started to get pulled out of high school.
Yep.
And back then, it wasn't even called vocational education. It was called the vocational arts. So we took the art out of skill, and then we took the skill out of the classroom. And then we started to say, look, there's one path, and it's the best path for the most people, and that path is a four-year degree. And if that weren't insane enough on the face of it, we all know what happened, you know, from 1980 until today. The cost of that four-year degree increased at a rate like no other commodity in the history of the world.
Right.
Right?
So every single year of my college career, tuition went up by, you know, double-digit percentages. So
it's insane. Faster than real estate, faster than energy, faster than inflation itself, faster than healthcare. Never before in the history of the world has anything deemed so important become so expensive so quickly. And what should have happened, in my opinion, is the market should have corrected itself. People should have looked around and said, wait a second, this is insane. We're telling our kids this is the only way to go if you want the best possible shot. And at the same time, we're raising the price to the roof. And then on top of that, we're going to free up over $1 trillion and encourage kids to take that kind of debt on. So, you know, when people ask me, you know, how is it that college got so expensive? You know, that's the answer. It got expensive because we told an entire generation that they were screwed without it. And at the same time, we encouraged them to borrow an unlimited amount of money to pay for it. If you ran a school, you'd raise tuition too.
Yeah. Yeah, you bring up a great point, Mike, about the cultural aspect of it. And I'm a little bit older than Neil, so I graduated high school in 1988, so I kind of lived through that whole era of the 80s. And you have brought this up, and you have the poster that you talk about where it said, you know, work smart, not hard. And it had the picture of the mechanic who supposedly is like,
yeah,
you know, this kind of loser guy. And even in pop culture, it was the same. I can recall it now, movies in the 80s where the plumber father was kind of like a big goofball or something like that, you know, and you're always aspiring to be the person who lived on the other side of town because their parents went to college and did these wonderful things. And, you know, it's funny because nowadays, and just give you a little story here, you know, when I drive to work, I work at a, you know, one of the big corporations, but I go through an area of town where there are three metal fastening / welding companies. There's one, a huge industrial type one. There's one that's like a mid-sized one. And there's one that actually has a sign that says, no job is too small. And I had seen help wanted signs in front of the mid-sized one and went in there, constantly saw help wanted, and went in there and asked one of them. It was a father and son operation. And I said, you know, I asked them, I said, what's the difficulty that you have in getting people to fill these jobs? He goes, there's just nobody around knows how to do it. He goes, the amount of money that I have to spend training people, he goes, if they've just held a welding machine at some point or just operated one, I'll hire them and I'll train them for a few months so that they know how to do it. But it's nearly impossible for me to find somebody that has the skills, the requisite skills to be able to do the job. And there's another company that's not right nearby that is an electrical and plumbing company, always have signs that say electricians wanted out front. So there are so many of these jobs available, and they, like you said, they pay very well. That is the, I think, the myth that needs to be destroyed, that this is something where you're going to earn the same as somebody who's working at McDonald's. That's just not the case.
It's not even close to the case. I mean, even if you were just to do a straight line comparison, you know, and some people do it, and look, you can use statistics really to confirm or deny any point you want to embrace or distance yourself from. People, I think most people intellectually know that. But the thing everybody forgets is even if an electrician is shown to be making the same or a superior salary to a typical white-collar position, what about the debt? Where's the student loan?
Right.
You're talking about 4 years of not being in the workforce versus being in the workforce. So a prudent worker is paying himself. He's saving money. She's saving money along the way. The graduate, you know, and again, it's not a slam on college. I wouldn't trade my college experience for anything, but it was different. You know, at $26 a credit back in 1982 at a community college, I could afford to be wrong. You can't afford to be wrong today. You're graduating with $40,000-$50,000 in debt. You're going to be paying that off for a long time. You're entering the workforce 4 years later than your counterpart. And, you know, it's just there are a lot of things that you don't really hear about in the admissions process that absolutely inform what's going to happen to you later. And again, I can't say this enough, guys. Every time I talk about this topic, somebody will hear this podcast and they will conclude very quickly, Mike's basically anti-education or anti-college.
Oh yeah.
I'm not. But the single most preposterous thing that's been omitted from this conversation in general over the last decade is the cost. It's just at some point I'm waiting for the other side to shrug their shoulders and say, you know what? You're right. It's just too expensive. Therefore, it doesn't matter how important it is. Therefore, you win. But so far, so far, I haven't heard it.
Just wait them out. Well, and Mike, we talk about costs and we talk about the, you know, the fiscal costs, but there are social costs, I think, as well. You alluded to one of them where the college student gets out into the world 4 years later than the person who goes to a vocational school and is, you know, working. That has, you know, that has monetary costs, but it also means that you're getting started on life 4 years later, and you're getting started on your life with a mountain of debt that you have to climb out from under. And since people generally tend to pair up with similarly, you know, situated people, you know, college students tend, I think that's the sociology. I may be incorrect on that, but tend to pair up with other, you know, college graduates and that sort of thing. Your spouse or partner also has a mountain of debt. So mm-hmm. you just combine your two mountains of debt and you're both clawing your way out of it. So you're eating ramen noodles for the first 2 or 3 years of your marriage or something like that, because you can barely pay rent and your student loans. That has costs. Those are opportunity costs. There are just all these many hidden factors to making this decision to go to get a four-year degree at a college versus getting into the workforce. And I think we see that manifesting in subtle ways. You know, the associations, you know, civic leagues, community organizations, that sort of thing. People across the socioeconomic ladder it's not as flat as it used to be. You don't go bowling with, you know, the lawyer doesn't go bowling with the plumber anymore.
Right.
Do you see that? Do you?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that it's a very, I think what you're saying is birds of a feather flock together. And I think, like most platitudes, there's a fair amount of truth in it.
Some.
And they do, you know, and it cuts both ways. You know, if you go to a typical union hall and sit down with a bunch of skilled laborers, it stands to reason you're going to have a different kind of conversation.
Very
than
different.
You are, right? And that's a shame, really, because that basic delineation is the thing that I think compels a lot of people to conclude that blue collar is way over here and white collar is way over there, and the gap between the two is the thing into which so many people are falling. But the truth is, in a healthy person and in a healthy workforce and in a civilized society that's actually working, blue and white collar, they're not on opposite ends of a yardstick. They're two sides of the same coin. And you know, Ayn Rand used to write about the muddy boots architect, which for her was sort of a prototypical example of somebody who really utilized both those parts of their brain, where there was a real intellectual curiosity combined with a willingness to put on your steel-toed boots and slog out into the construction site and get your hands on the I-beam and build the thing, you know? That kind of a holistic, balanced worker used to be very common, and today is in really, really short supply. And part of it's for the reason that you've suggested, I think. And the other part is just because we live in a specialized society where, never mind all the biases and, you know, perceptions and misperceptions that tend to separate us, we just have this overarching assumption right now that the specialist is the more valuable thing. And that's certainly the case if you need a new heart valve. You know, but the idea of a general practitioner in all vocations, that's on the ropes, and that's too bad, because really being able to ply any of the trades that you mentioned earlier that you're capable of doing, you know, that is every bit as important as being able to sit down and intellectually engage with Plato or Aristotle or Descartes. You know, these things aren't opposites. They're both important. And when we promote one at the expense of the other, we wind up churning out hollow people.
We do, and it creates a gap in the perception of how our life ought to be versus how it is, and that makes us unhappy. You know, we see other people, and this is, you know, this ties into problems with social media and how people portray themselves in public and that sort of thing. But we assign the value to the 4-year college degree. And so that has the higher social status. And so that's the glamorous life of the you know, educated person who reads literature, blah, blah, blah. That's not closed to a blue-collar worker, that not at all. But because of these perceptions we have, these competing perceptions, we have the college-educated 4-year degree way up here, and then we have the blue-collar vocational worker way down here, and the gap between those two in our perception is full of just this social anxiety and comparing ourselves to one another. It leads to a fair amount of unhappiness. All of these things just sort of tie into one another. You know, there's so many factors at play.
Yeah. I mean, look, you just said happiness. The vocational equivalent of happiness is satisfaction. Everybody wants to talk about job satisfaction. And, you know, this again is really as much of a social disconnect as anything else, but the idea that there's a path to satisfaction or happiness is something that we've absolutely bought into. With respect, the most current generation, I think, is the best example of it. But we all, to a certain degree, love to believe the idea that if I do A, it'll lead to B, and that'll lead to C, right? And so the path to success has a beginning. And if you were to ask a lot of people today what that first step is, I believe you would hear in general, well, the first step is identify your dream. You know, take a deep breath, look around the world, and decide what it is that's going to make you happy. And then you decide, okay, well, where am I going to go get the training and the education I need to get to the next step? And then you'll do that. And then you'll say, okay, I've got that. So where am I going to go now in order to apply these things? That's the process of looking for the job. And then you go down that road and then you get the job. And then you say, okay, well, I'm still not really happy. So how long do I stay here? And why aren't I happy? Is it because my boss has it in for me? Is it because I had to move to the wrong state? Blah, 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 blah. Point being, if job satisfaction hinges on the idea that it's your job that makes you happy, you're screwed. Just as if happiness is this thing that, you know, interpersonal happiness with your mate, if that all starts with the idea that there is a soulmate out there in the world, just waiting for you to find her or him, then your entire life is going to come down to this quixotic search for the person who's going to make you happy. I think that's happening in our country now way more than it ever used to. And I think it's migrated into the search for a good job. I think a lot of people get out of school with the idea that says, okay, I want job satisfaction. In order to get it, I have to find the job that will satisfy me. And the minute you take that bait, you've just dramatically decreased your odds of ever experiencing anything like satisfaction or happiness. Jesus, I sound like Dr. Phil.
No, that tracks very well with my experience when I got out of college, Mike. I've got to say, I was, you know, nurtured in that whole environment and got out of college with my, you know, 4-year degree, and I was like, yeah, I'm you know,
Yeah.
And I can go out and just walk on to whatever job I want because obviously I'm amazing and qualified. So boom, nope. Yeah.
Well, and now the thing is, Mike, and we're going to get into your foundation here in a minute, but and this isn't really about trades, but this is more, and I just want to see what you think about this, is that in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been an explosion in what they call like coding boot camps, these schools that teach people how to do coding, how to do front end development or Ruby on Rails, that kind of thing. Instead of going to college and getting and going through 4 years of a degree and waiting to get a computer science degree, you know, these schools are saying, okay, you pay us a flat rate anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000. And within 3 to 6 months, we're going to equip you with the skills that you need to be able to get like a junior developer position at some kind of company. And we'll actually help you do that. In fact, some of these schools guarantee that if you don't get a job within X amount of months of going to this school and kind of graduating, that they will refund the tuition to them. Now I know that there's, and like I said, we talk about your foundation, there's technical schools all across the country, but do you think that there's a market? And sometimes you don't want to use the word market, but it's the best word to use in this case. Is there a market for something like that, for somebody to come along and say, I'm going to open up this training center that's just going to be about teaching people how to be an electrician? And you're going to come in for 6 months and it's going to cost you this, which is going to cost you about a third of what it's going to be to get a college degree. And after 6 months, you will be a licensed electrician and you'll be able to go and work somewhere or kind of work for yourself. Do you kind of see that happening? Is there any kind of market for that?
Well, if there's any logic in the universe, yeah, it's going to happen. And the market forces, as long as we're talking about the market, are going to make it inevitable. We're just not going to be able to afford the typical tuition and degreed approach much longer. Look, let's be honest, we can't afford it now. We got $1.3 trillion in outstanding student loans. The whole conversation is academic, pardon the pun. But look, here's the trap and here's the trick that I think is ultimately good news if we look at it this way. People used to say, this is no good because what you're describing is very, very, very codified. You know, it's very specific and great. You're going to take a kid and you're going to teach her or him a very, very specific skill. And then they're going to work. And that's all they're going to be. They're going to be this worker who takes this one skill. And so they're not well-rounded. They're not unlimited in their capacity to satisfy anything close to intellectual curiosity. They're just this trained worker to do this specific thing. I used to believe, and I still do, that that's a fair criticism because, you know, to the earlier point, we don't just want a society full of people who are really good at one thing. And, right. And we're looking at idiocracy, you know, ultimately. It's people just aren't competent in enough key areas. But look, when college was really getting its big push, the thing that they were delivering that was so valuable wasn't just information or education or insight or knowledge, all the things you get there. They were delivering something that truly didn't exist 40 years ago, and that was access. You went to college because college couldn't come to you. And so you had to pay whatever you paid to get in there and then to let this hopefully well-rounded, broad-based, liberal education, and I say liberal meaning, you know, the classic sense of the word, well-rounded.
Of course.
You know, you needed the access in order to get that thing. Right now, I'm talking to you guys on a device the size of a deck of cards, Skyping in this bold new world, and on this same device with a couple of tweaks and a push, I can access 99.8% of all the known information on the planet gathered in the history of time. I can look at a high-end math lecture from Harvard for free on this device. My point is, yeah, we have to do exactly what you've described. And at the same time, we have to do something to stimulate an overall sense of curiosity in people's minds and encourage them to scratch that itch in order to give them the thing that they used to get only in college. The access now to general broad-based liberal education is amazing, and it's free. It's the cost of a phone. And hell, those things are free too, as far as I understand. So, I mean, there's never been a better opportunity to do the exact thing you've just described.
Mm-hmm. So where does MicroWorks come in here? We talk about access to all this knowledge or information that we have, what's the mission of MicroWorks? It seems to me that part of that mission of MicroWorks is to help people access this body of knowledge and these practical skills as well.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's really twofold. Like I said before, it evolved because when the economy tanked, I thought it would be good for me to do something helpful for the industries that had allowed dirty jobs to prosper. And the most obvious thing I could find was some sort of public way to make a case for jobs that actually existed. And so that is still front and center. You know, when the recession was at its peak, the skills gap, we had about 2.3 million jobs. Now we have 5.8. So it's gotten a lot wider. So in that sense, I guess I failed utterly. but at the same time, we're saying, look, if these are the jobs that exist and this is the training that's required, then maybe I should raise some money and try and reward the very behavior we're attempting to encourage. So in short, what MicroWorks does is award work ethic scholarships to people who are willing to learn a skill that's actually in demand, while at the same time, it allows me to go out into the world and be interviewed by, you know, all sorts of people and remind them that the reason 30 million people perfectly capable of working are not working at the moment is not because there are no jobs. That's not the reason. And if I say anything else, you know, it'll turn into a political conversation and I don't want it to. So I never say anything else. But that's why this topic is so huge. It's universal. And, you know, we can talk about work and labor and all sorts of other things, but you brought up the social element a couple of times. And it really is unavoidable. When you point to 6 million available jobs and 30 million people who are not working, something is disconnected. Something is fundamentally just not lining up. And so that's what my foundation does. It says, look, statistically, I'm sure that a lot of people who would like to work could be if they understood the skills that were required. And if they were willing to hit the reset button in their own life. And then finally, the third thing that nobody talks about anymore, but is really important, is are you willing to go to where the work is? Or are you able to go to where the work is?
To relocate.
That's right.
Uh-huh. That's a big one.
I mean, look, I don't know when this happened, but, you know, this is the whole country formed because we're a restless people, pushing west, pushing manifest destiny, all of that, always moving. Somehow or other, you'd be amazed at the number of people who apply for these scholarships. And we go down the list and we start to talk to them about what they're comfortable doing, what they're not comfortable doing. I'm telling you, the expectation is not only should my dream job exist, not only should it pay me what I'm pretty sure I deserve to be paid, I'm going to need one in my zip code, please.
we had a conversation with Dana Perino, who was the former press secretary to George W. Bush.
Yeah, I know.
And
Dana.
Yeah, and one of the things that she had said was, and just kind of talk about what you said here, is like, hey, treat life like it's an adventure. If you have a job opportunity in Indianapolis and you're currently living in New Jersey, go for it. You know, make that jump, go out to Indianapolis, live there for 5 years, then move to South Carolina for a few years. I mean, I think what you're right. There's this kind of like bubble mentality that says I need to have, like you said, need to have a job, need to have a zip code, need to have it 10 minutes from my house, or else, you know, this isn't any good. I mean, that kind of explains part of the reason why so many people are still living with their parents.
Well, it's one of the unintended consequences of the access I was just talking about. You know, I don't even know if she's around anymore. Her name was Faith Popcorn, and she used to publish this thing called the Popcorn Report, which was a fascinating look at sociological trends that were informing key life decisions. And she used to write a thing, this is way prior to the internet, but she was really focused on the delivery business and the way people were no longer being forced to go out for dinner or out to see a movie, right? All these different technologies that were allowing people to what she called cocoon. So cocooning became a thing in the 80s that people talked about was going to be very, very important because it's informing the way people just stay closer and closer to their home. And then, of course, with the advent of the internet and all the other technologies that are self-evident, she came back and said, you know what, it's not cocooning anymore, it's something else. And she called it, burrowing. Right, so we went from cocooning to burrowing. So what Dana is saying, and what I'm saying, is really the same thing. You have to embrace all the good that can come from going down, you know, the YouTube, Google rabbit hole into this great, fun world of interconnected, serendipitous surprises that requires you to not even get out of your bed. You have to somehow push back against that, because if you don't, you will never leave New Jersey. You'll never get to Indianapolis or South Carolina or Bend, Oregon, or San Francisco, or anywhere. And so, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of forces that I think are not really obvious that have conspired to keep us weirdly sedentary.
It is strange, and it extends right on down to kids not getting their driver's licenses anymore. Now, I'm on the old side of the millennial generation, so I'm like the oldest of the millennials. And when I was 16, I could not wait to get behind the wheel, get out of the house, go meet my buddies, and, you know, just get into general no good hijinks. By the time my youngest brother came along, and he was born in 1990, something had shifted in the same generation, and there was just not this burning desire to get behind the wheel of this, you know, clickety-clackety old, you know, death trap and toddle on down the road to go swipe beer from, you know, the grocery store.
Well, so, look, it was no different when I was 16, except for the fact that we weren't talking about who was going to drive us. You know, we were talking about who was going to change our oil. So, like, for me, it wasn't about getting behind the wheel. It was about getting under the hood. Right? So you're 16. It's like, okay, here's what you do. Your uncle or your grandfather or, you know, somebody down the street with a big heart is going to give you a piece of crap automobile. That's yours, right? Or you're going to pay $100 for it. And you're going to get under the hood, and you're going to learn about spark plugs. You're going to learn about carburetors. You're going to learn about four-stroke engines, the slant six, and the old Dodge Dart never, never, ever died. You're going to learn how to change the oil. You're going to understand how this machine works, and then you're going to get to drive it.
Yep.
And then you're going to get to have passengers, and then you're going to get insurance. You're going to have to pay for that. But you're going to, like, you, everything started a click back. What you're saying is exactly what Faith Popcorn was talking about. Now, the biggest decision from getting from A to B is, man, I don't know. They got the new Uber pool, but the Uber X is cheaper, but here's the black car. What do you say, honey? Let's celebrate. Get ourselves a black car tonight. No, let's get the SUV. God, life is so difficult with all these decisions. Who is going to drive me tonight? Or maybe we get Lyft and one of those guys with the funny little mustache. Right? So it's the same conversation, but it's now been pushed a whole nother level forward. You got to push back against it. Otherwise, it's altered states, and we're just all going to be in our different little tubes, you know, suspended in some homeostatic state, just doing some goofy crap with the reptilian part of our brains and calling it a workout.
Man, that is a great point.
And Mike, you just had to give me a flashback to me climbing under my car and banging on the starter, waiting until you see a spark, and then you know, okay, we're good. Now we can go.
Yeah. Look, I mean, when I say, like, I wrote this fake book a couple years ago called Profoundly Disconnected, and, you know, I was trying to come at that very thing from as many different directions as I could, but we're not under the car anymore, and we're not banging on the starter, and we're not – we're disconnected from, never mind which Uber to call, although that, to be fair, is a relative kind of disconnect. We're disconnected from the basic mechanics of everything. And I'm not saying that as though I'm any different. I opened the hood to my car the other day, which is, you know, an 8-year-old Ford. And damn it, it still looked like a rocket engine. You know, I mean, it's encased in plastic and it's extruded, and I don't recognize anything. You know, mechanics today, that's part of the reason my foundation is committed to training them. It's computer science. It's rocket science. It's a totally different thing than it used to be. And, you know, in a way that I don't think has ever been rivaled. The people who now rely on cars have never been more disconnected from their basic mechanics,
right,
in the history of cars. But you could say the same thing about everything, from the iPhone to basic construction. We are disconnected, it feels like, from damn near everything we depend upon.
And that's the goal of and that's part of the goal of the foundation, is to kind of reconnect people with that. And one of the things, I was looking at the success stories, because, you know, going back again to talking about college, and, you know, again, it's not looking down on college. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because there was that, you know, not to get political here, but when Scott Walker was considering running for president, Scott Walker did not have a college degree, but he was a very effective governor, had done a great job, but there were people who were saying that they wouldn't vote for him because he didn't go to college. And if you said, well, that's ridiculous, he can do the job, then all of a sudden people were saying, oh, you're thinking people who go get degrees are snobs. There's a businessman who said, he goes, look, I have nothing against college degrees. He goes, I'm glad my doctor has one. He says, but when it comes to, like, the company that I run, he says, it's not something that we consider first above everything else, especially life experience. So one of the success stories that you showed here was a young man who was going to a technical school, and he was actually working, being paid for the skill that he had, but he was also going to college to study aerospace and mechanical engineering. But as a result of him already having a job, he would be able to do that without having to graduate $100,000 in debt.
Sure. Again, it's balance.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I feel kind of silly telling these stories, because the exclamation point or the punchline is always, it's kind of boring. This is a story about somebody who realized, you know, just because you're at the all-you-can-eat buffet doesn't mean you have to eat until you explode. Just because you qualify to go to William and Mary or University of Pennsylvania doesn't mean you have to. Just because you qualify for, you know, $120,000 in loans doesn't mean you should sign on the dotted line. It's like, you know, basic common sense. You either informs your decision or it doesn't. And, you know, again, it's, I'm not saying it's a mistake to borrow money to go to school. I'm just saying that there is an unbelievable amount of pressure that's put on kids. You know, declare the major. First of all, find the school, apply for the loan, declare the major. Before you're even a sophomore, you're down a road. You know, you are going down a road. And if you happen to be normal, well, what's going to happen is you're going to realize in 2 years that's not the road you thought it was, or you don't really like where it's leading. And you know, I'm repeating myself here because that shouldn't be a problem. We should be perfectly fine changing our minds at 25, but we can't anymore without incurring this, you know, you've got this millstone on your back. So those success stories that come out of MicroWorks, they're kind of boring because all they really tell you is, yeah, here's a person who decided that the practical reality of making a living is going to require them to first and foremost earn money. So what's the best way to do that? Well, that would be get a job. But that's not where the conversation should end. You know, how do you do the other things that make you well-rounded? How do you do the other things that will give you balance in your world? And I look for people who figured that out. It's not complicated, but it's a lot harder to do with $100,000 in debt over your head than it is if you have the freedom to be wrong. That's why I always say Essex Community College in 1980, man, I didn't know my ass from a hot rock. Remember, what I wanted to do was follow in my granddad's footsteps. He was the guy who said, son, get a different toolbox. You can be a tradesman if you want, but give me a break. You're not going to hang drywall. I had just botched up pouring a foundation. I got the mix wrong in the concrete. And he was just like, look, this is, you know, it's too hard for you. It's not coming easily. I just brought home from wood shop, like a sconce, you know, that I'd done on a bandsaw. It looked like a paramecium. He's like, dude, just give it up, you know, just give it up, go in a different direction. So, you know, when I went to community college, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. So I majored in, I took courses in every single thing from English to philosophy, to acting, to music, to all of it. And very, very little of it led to where I ultimately wound up going. But all of it was not only valuable, it was affordable. And again, if you take the affordability out of that kind of experimentation, you've just fundamentally moved my cheese, you know, and I'm not gonna come out the other end the same way. It's just not gonna happen.
Well, you know, Mike, you say that those experiences and you know, college didn't really lead to where you are now, but you know, I think I'd like to quibble with you there because you have, I think, occupied a very unique cultural space here. You are able to speak, you know, act as an interpreter between these two, you know, groups of people who sometimes just don't understand one another. You have had a very diverse career. You know, I think you sang opera for a time.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have just this great ability to connect with people and to tell stories and to really draw people in. And I think that's incredibly valuable for your work.
Well, look,
but go ahead.
First of all, thanks. You know, I probably could have worded it better. What I meant was the things you just described do in fact inform a lot of what I do today, but they don't make much money. The thing I get paid for, the reason I've done well is because I did start, you know, back with that earlier question, you know, when you're talking about how do you train somebody to really get a skill that will get them in the door? Well, you know, I learned how to sing and that got me in the opera, and the opera got me into a position where I could buy my Screen Actors Guild card.
basically pay the dues for that. That got me in a position where I could take some more classes, learn some more stuff about advertising, and got cast in a couple of commercials. So, you know, when I look back at it, for me, there was a whole column of skill that I needed to get in order to get paid. And I was always very mercenary about that. The missionary stuff. Look, there's always a mercenary position and a missionary position, and both are underrated, you know. And I was always trying to learn as much as I could and to study as many different things as I could that didn't necessarily have anything to do with me getting paid. And that's still the case today. What you're seeing, and it's a fair observation, but you know, this is a really fun conversation. I'm glad we had it, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to send me a check for it, and that's cool. I want one. You know, I don't. There's a whole list of stuff that I don't get paid to do that's really important to me now. And look, the best and luckiest thing I can tell you is that I'm in a position where I can take time to do things that I do think are important, that are engaging, and that are fun, and not only don't make me money, they cost me money. But that's really important. But again, it's that other side to the coin. You know, an hour from now, I'm going to go over to a recording studio and I'm going to sit down here in San Francisco and I'm going to narrate 2 hours of Deadliest Catch for the Discovery Channel.
Awesome.
And I'm going to get paid for it. You know, some might say overpaid, but look, I'll take every penny, right? And so, you know, to an alien from some other galaxy watching me walk around today, talking to you right now vis-a-vis Skype and to my cell phone, and then watching me walk over and sit behind a microphone and continue, you know, making these same movements with my lips, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, this guy, this is what he does. This is a guy who walks around and talks. Some of it yields money. Some of it doesn't. And you know, that's probably an inelegant way to put it, but in the end, you have to be a whole functioning, balanced sort of person, but you don't have to get paid every time you open your mouth or every time you do a thing, you know, that you might be known for or good at.
Well, hey Mike, we're podcasters. We know all about doing something you enjoy and not getting paid for it.
You guys wrote the book on that.
Yeah.
Well, you're in the podcasting world too now, right?
Well, it's a great example of what we're talking about. I'm trying to figure out how to make money doing it, but I'm not obsessed with it because I love it. You know, I'm doing this thing. Do you remember Paul Harvey by any chance?
Absolutely.
I do.
Yeah, Paul. He was the guy. I mean, which one of you is the young one? Neil, right?
Yeah, Neil's the young one.
That's me. Yeah.
All right.
Now, I caught Paul Harvey, though. I did. I caught him.
Really? Okay. Well, I mean, when I was in my 30s, I can't tell you how many times I'd be driving somewhere and I get to where I'm going and I would just sit in the car listening because I had to hear the end of the rest of the story. And that was the name of these 5-minute biographical mysteries that Paul Harvey used to do. So I'm just trying to pay a little homage to him, and my podcast is called The Way I Heard It. And it's the same way of telling a story about a famous person. You don't know who I'm talking about until the end, unless you figure it out as I go. But it's not a podcast in the sense that I'm not just sitting down and talking. I actually write them, and then I record them. And you guys probably know better than I if this is good or not, but we've done three and a half months of them, and I only do one a week, but we've reached about 25 million people. And
that's awesome.
And that's great. Yeah,
so yeah, people are calling and saying, hey, you've reached 25 million people. You should be doing this every day. And of course I can't do them every day, but I like writing them and I like reading them. And I think that, you know, I think there is a market. I think people are still curious. I just think our attention spans are shorter than they've ever been. So well, podcast is for the curious mind with a short attention span.
Yeah, well, it works out because it's only about 6 to 8 minutes long, and I've listened, and it's really good, because these stories, because I like the fact that, that I've listened to several of them and trying to figure out who it is that you're talking about until you get to the end. I figured out one, not the other, but that's the great thing about it. So it's really good. I would suggest anybody who's listening to this, make sure you go over to MikeRowe/podcast and subscribe to his, because I think you'll enjoy it. Well, Mike, we're about out of time, but we really appreciate you doing this. We do have one.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was a lot of fun.
We really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Thanks.
But there is one thing that we have to do, and this is the one thing that we put our guests on the spot about. So this is, and don't worry, it's not political or anything like that. I don't think it's going to get you in any trouble.
It's our only gotcha question that we do, and we encourage you to answer honestly and not to worry about any kind of negative repercussions. Okay. We just want to get your honest opinion about this. Okay.
So as you can hear in the background, Dean Martin is playing. And so Neil and I have this back and forth thing over between Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. One of us is a Sinatra guy. The other guy's a Dean Martin guy. And so we ask each guest at the end of the show, if you're going to pick one, who would it be? Would it be Frank Sinatra or would it be Dean Martin?
To listen to or to be?
To listen to.
Wow. I love that question. I love it because Dean Martin, nobody figured out a better way to live through their art, in my opinion, than Dean Martin. I think he had more fun day by day than really just about anybody else who could sing. But Sinatra, nobody told more stories better through music than Frank. So I'm afraid my answer has got to be Sinatra, only because you didn't tell me how long a period of time I would need to be with each artist.
Okay.
So my assumption is I can only listen to one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
They're the only one I'm going to be able to listen to for some protracted period of time. So I assume I'm on a desert island. I assume it's one or the other.
Right.
You've got one single. Okay. So it's not okay. But who would you say is just overall who you'd want to hang out with?
Oh,
Dean,
Dean,
right?
Martin. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Neil gets his consolation prize.
Right? I have to get the consolation prize.
Well, so. Look, I mean, it's very important the way you frame the question. If it's, who do I want to go sit and have a beer with and talk to about the world for an hour or two, it's Dean Martin.
All the way.
Yeah. But if, who do I want, whose music do I want to live with for the rest of my life, if I have to choose the lexicon, one or the other, I'm going with Sinatra, just because there's just too many different chapters in that cat's book. There's just, Dino did a few things better than anybody. Sinatra did a lot of things better than everybody.
All right. Well, that's going to do it. Mike, thanks again. We had so much fun. This was great. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to. And what am I? Episode 11?
Episode 11.
Episode 11, yeah. Neil and I have been doing this for about 3 years, but we just started this new one about several months ago. So we branched out to something different.
Hey, man, look, I'm honored. In the words of, I think it was Christopher Guest in Spinal Tap, this one goes to 11.
This one goes to 11. I think that's the title for this podcast.
Oh, there we go. That is it.
But we do appreciate it, Mike. We appreciate your time, and we appreciate you hanging out and being such a great guest. And we encourage our listeners to go check out the MikeRowe Foundation. Maybe think about donating. Who knows? And also subscribe to Mike's podcast, because it really is a lot of fun to listen to.
Awesome. It is. And that's going to do it for this time on the Fifth Estate. We'll see you next time.